Go ahead and be seated.
All right, first matter we've got on today is docket number 68025, U.S. Home Court versus Harris. Are we ready to go?
Sure, ready.
All right, come on up. Did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, if I could reserve 3 minutes.
Okay.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Greg King. I am representing the appellant developers, U.S. Home and Greystone, Nevada, in this matter. Let me start by saying what this court does not have to do today, and that is to decide whether or not arbitration is a good thing, whether it's an important thing, and whether there should be a public policy to support arbitration. And that's because that's already been decided by the Nevada and by the federal legislatures. Instead, in light of that public policy, this court needs to decide whether the two arbitration provisions, the two arbitration agreements at issue, are so unconscionable, both procedurally and substantively, that they cannot be enforced. And more precisely, whether the homeowners have met their burden of showing, of proving that they are unconscionable, and whether there is substantial evidence to justify the lower court's ruling that these agreements are unconscionable. Related to that is the issue, if this court believes there are terms or provisions within these arbitration agreements that are objectionable or with which this court is concerned, whether those provisions can simply be stricken, can be severed in accordance with the severability provisions contained within both arbitration agreements.
Let me ask you this, just a quick question. One of the issues was that these buyers were not informed as part of that arbitration clause of the, as to their Chapter 40 remedies, the waiver of attorney's fees and the waiver of Chapter 40 damages. Can you address that?
Absolutely. Let me make it absolutely clear that the developers have no intention of taking away any Chapter 40 rights from any of the homeowners. The developers have gone through the Chapter 40 process with regard to all these claims, and we believe that the provisions do not take away those rights. But let me address specifically some provisions that may be of concern to the court. With regard to the U.S. Home Purchase and Sell Agreement, that's the agreement that applies to 13 of the 14 homes. There's a provision that says the attorney, that the parties shall bear their own fees and costs, but it also says unless otherwise provided by law.
It also has the buyers and the builder, from what I understand, splitting the cost of arbitration. Is that correct?
For the U.S. home agreement, I believe that is correct. But recall that there is a provision. You have Chapter 40 does apply, and the homeowners are entitled to recoup all of their fees and costs through 40.655 as a damage remedy. Again, the key phrase in that U.S. home agreement, it says unless otherwise provided by law. And as this court said in D.R. Horton versus Green, the arbitrators need to apply this substantive law. You apply that law in an arbitral form. You can't disregard the law. And if the law under Chapter 40 is that the homeowners are not to pay for their fees and costs, and we know under the Albiol's decision, that's a discretionary element to the trial court as a damage element. But the arbitrator needs to apply that law in deciding what's appropriate and what fees and costs should be awarded.
But the clause on the U.S. Homes one says, the unless otherwise provided by law, the cost of mediation and arbitration shall be borne equally. I understand that that modifies cost, but then I don't see a similar lead-in to the provision it makes for attorney's fees. Where is that?
And we're looking at the U.S. Home?
Yes.
Provision? I'm focused on the third paragraph that says otherwise provided by law the cost. If we're looking at the end of the first paragraph in Section 18, it says the arbitrator shall have the right to award attorney's fees and expenses. If that's what, Justice Pickering, if that's what you're focused on, that, to me, that is a provision that states that the arbitrator does have the right to award fees and costs.
What if he doesn't?
I'm sorry?
What if he doesn't, he, she, they, the arbitrator?
If the arbitrator does not award the fees and costs?
If the arbitrator sees it as a discretionary call on their part, and the agreement provides that discretion, don't we have a problem with Chapter 40 remedies and other entitlements that come or flow from Chapter 40?
Thank you. That's exactly the question.
I think the case law is clear, and I think under D.R. Horton versus Green, the case law is clear that the arbitrator is obligated to follow the law.
Your agreement doesn't say that, and you didn't say that just now a minute ago. You said it's discretionary.
Well, my point was under the Albuelos decision, the district court itself doesn't have to award attorney's fees. There's a discretionary element to that. And my point is that same law, that same discretion would apply to the arbitrator.
And I got reversed on Albuelos because I didn't award enough attorney's fees. So it wasn't discretionary. This court said I was committed a boo-boo.
Okay. Well,
in Albuelos, I remember it very well. I spent quite a few days in that trial.
Okay. And I'm not here to argue the merits of the Albuelos. The point is the law as it stands should apply to arbitrators. It's not a grounds for not enforcing arbitration based upon the concern that the arbitrator will not follow the law. They are entitled to follow the law. If they don't follow the law, that's one of those few grounds that you can overturn an arbitrator's decision. If they
manifestly disregard the law. Yeah.
Right. So I think we are protected in that way.
I have a question about procedural and substantive unconscionability.
Sure.
Does a homeowner have to prove both of those or one or the other to prevail on unconscionability? In other words, you have procedural and substantive. If it's procedural, can they prevail? If it's substantive, can they prevail? Or does it have to be both procedural and substantive? I'm a little confused on that.
Sure. No, you have to have both elements. And both the R. Horton case and the Gonski case reinforce that idea that you need to have both. Now, there is that sliding scale. And in D.R. Horton, this court said, well, we don't have much in the way of substantive unconscionability, but in light of all of the procedural unconscionability, we're going to find it was unconscionable. Gonski was the other way. It ruled that the procedural unconscionability wasn't much, but the substantive was.
I'm going to ask respondent to comment on that also about both or one or the other.
But yeah, and I think that's a key element because I think with regard to these agreements, especially with regard to the Greystone standalone agreement, I think it's very difficult to argue that there's procedural unconscionability. The issue with procedural unconscionability is, are the arbitration agreements and terms readily ascertainable? When you have a 3-page standalone agreement, I think it's hard to argue that it's not ascertainable. The other thing I'd like to point out and emphasize, it's in our papers, NRS 119-182, it gives every home buyer a 5-day cool-down period, an opt-out period. After they sign that agreement, they have 5 days to go back, look at their agreements, look at their CC&Rs, look at what they've entered into, look at the arbitration provisions, and if they decide, you know what, I was rushed into this, I don't want to enter into an arbitration agreement, as long as we do so within 5 days, they can bail out of the agreement, and they can get all their money back.
What about if they want to bail out of the agreement and still purchase the home? Hypothetically, what do you think would happen?
Well, I think at that point, they would need to approach the developer and try to negotiate the whatever their concern is, the reason for them wanting to bail out of the agreement, they would need to go to the developer and say, hey, here's my concern, start that negotiation process. I mean, I think it's important to note that in none of the 13 declarations provided by the homeowners in this case, in no instance did they suggest that they try to negotiate any of these terms.
You mentioned something earlier that if we ended up having an issue with the arbitration clause, we can strike portions of it. In this case, wouldn't it be more appropriate that we would have to write in something if we found that For instance, there was no notice that the buyers were waiving their Chapter 40 rights.
I don't think so. I don't think so, because I don't think that the provisions can be read that way. I don't think the agreements are so permeated, and I think that's the standard, so permeated with unconscionable terms that by taking out those provisions, you're going to leave a shell of an agreement that will require you to insert your own provisions. For instance, under the, to me, the most objectionable, the most provision of most concern is the Greystone standalone agreement. It's that last sentence of the contract, which says, the parties shall each bear their own attorney's fees in any arbitration pursuant to Section 5. This provision doesn't have the unless otherwise provided by law provision. I think it would be perfectly appropriate. Our clients have consistently maintained at the lower court level and in our papers here that it would be appropriate to strike that provision. Striking that provision would in our view, make this agreement no longer unconscionable.
So in terms of perhaps an aside, I presume that all of those agreements that you have, your client has drafted since these, no longer has that clause in it?
It is safe to say, yes, that the agreements being drafted by my clients have been revised, and they make it absolutely clear that the parties have their Chapter 40 rights and that their remedies, and there's no intent to take those away. Absolutely.
Are you,
as a lesson well learned.
Okay. You were making your arguments based upon Greystone, but as to U.S. Homes, are you conceding that this is unconscionable because of its inconspicuous nature, or is that an argument you're going to make for us?
With regard to the, on the provision I said to be quick.
As to U.S. Homes. Okay, Greystone.
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. In light of the Concepcion case, the key is, are these provisions ascertainable, and they need to be on equal footing with other provisions of the contract. The U.S. Home Agreement is a 4.5-page agreement. The arbitration provision in paragraph 18, it's hard to miss if you go through the agreement. Again, under
hard to miss for an attorney or hard to miss for a layperson who might buy two or three homes during their whole lifetime?
That's a great question. That's always the challenge, is to draft agreements in a way that will be understandable to a layperson.
Normally we talk in terms of setting out certain provisions in bold print and things like that, or some kind of different font, to bring to the party's attention that there's something different, that they're giving something up, or you're changing something. That doesn't seem to be, was not done here.
Well, I would point out that the agreement, its title is boldened, arbitration of disputes. Now, if I understand your point, Justice Douglas, it's not highlighted more than maybe some other provisions, but I don't think that's the requirement. And I think,
and indeed, under the federal cases, if our law imposed that requirement, it would be deeply problematic under Concepcion and the others, would it not?
Concepcion, in the preceding cases, in the posting cases,
Concepcion doesn't go that far to completely strike down state law as to unconscionability. You can, in some cases, even with the FAA, look at state law if it doesn't, in fact, just totally outright reject federal law. So there's some bastion.
Sure.
Maybe on life support, still alive.
Sure. And I think D.R. Horton is the example where, in that case, you had an arbitration provision on the back page of a sales agreement in smaller font, and we had an evidentiary hearing in which the judge entertained testimony and argument, and it was made clear the reason the homeowners were not aware of the arbitration provision is because of the location of the arbitration agreement on the back page, after the signature page. And also, there was evidence of the sales agent downplaying the importance of that agreement. There's nothing like that here. And I do think it would be inappropriate. I understand the basis for ruling of unconscionability under state law. But if you're, they need, arbitration provisions need to be held on the same footing as other provisions. And the courts should not go out of their way and hold arbitration provisions to a higher standard than any other provisions within the contract. It should be held at the same level.
To be very candid, we've gone through a period of, and I'll just use the term, beat down by the U.S. Supreme Court as to the arbitration provisions. But be that as it may, is it your position that it gives fair notice that the buyers in the U.S. home contract are giving up certain rights?
I apologize. I'm not sure I understood the question.
Does this give fair notice that they were waiving their Chapter 40 rights as to attorneys' fees and costs and potential proximate damages?
Sure. Again, I don't believe Chapter 40 is being waived in these agreements, especially if you sever out that last
sentence. But as it stands, it reads right now, and we can debate whether we can sever or not, but does it?
The U.S. home agreements, no. And the Greystone agreement, I don't believe so either. The Greystone agreement says you shall bear your own cost during the arbitration, much like you do through litigation. But again, the arbitrator has to apply the law and the remedies at the end of the case. NRS 119-182 gives those homeowners 5 days to figure out, if it doesn't understand some legal terms or some jargon. And I think arbitration is something more and more lay people are aware of. It's certainly something that's throughout many contracts in our daily lives.
So is it your position that 5-day cure period overcomes, even if this is not drafted the way it should be, that it cures it?
It could certainly be a factor in curing that, right? I believe it can be a factor, absolutely.
Okay, we asked you quite a few questions, so I'm going to give you 2 additional minutes, and I'll forward that to opposing counsel as well.
Okay. I'll take that now.
Well, actually, for rebuttal.
Oh, I will.
Thank you. Your time. And I should say, before counsel approaches, you'll notice Justice Hardesty isn't here today. He had a little procedure on his knee, but he is watching the webcast, and he will be participating in the deliberation afterward.
Mr. Shinnick, if you could answer my question as I asked the appellant about procedural and substantive, this has to be both. Can it be either? I'd like your view on that, your interpretation of procedural and substantive.
Yes, Your Honor. Dwayne Shinnick for the homeowner respondents. May it please the court. With respect to the analysis for unconscionability, both procedural and substantive unconscionability are to be shown in order for a contract to be determined to be not enforceable under Nevada law, is my understanding.
So if it's just procedural, there can be arbitration. If it's substantive, there can be arbitration. But it has to be both, is what you're saying?
It has to be both, although, as counsel mentioned, there is a sliding scale between a degree of procedural unconscionability and a degree of substantive unconscionability. Here we have, going to the U.S. home agreement first, the procedural unconscionability goes to the text. It goes to the title being capitalized of arbitration disputes, but the rest of the text, nothing drawing it to the attention of the home buyer that there are important rights being given up. That relates to the same issue about whether homeowners were informed about the existence of any such homeowner rights. Neither one of these agreements, dating from 2003 referred in any sense to the existence of Chapter 40 rights, much less to the detail of what damages are recoverable, what costs are recoverable, what fees are recoverable, what right to repair terms might be available, what response dates might be available, any of those sorts of things. So in terms of informing prospective buyers that they did have some rights that they were about to give up by this contract, and make it clear, I want to make it clear, they are giving rights up by this contract.
What about counsel's argument that they're not, because the clause is qualified by language unless law provides otherwise?
Yes, Your Honor. I appreciate counsel's comment and argument interpreting what this contract means, but that's not what the contract says. The only term that says unless provided by law is the shared cost for mediation and arbitration costs. It does not refer to the rest of the Chapter 40 rights. And I want to go not just fees and costs or interest or relocations for structural. Let's go to the very basis of Chapter 40. What are defects? What are the damages that are allowed to be recovered in terms of past repair costs, future repair costs? What qualifies as a defect? Because that's where it's the departure starts between these contracts and what Nevada law is.
Counsel, all of that is contained within the statutory scheme of Chapter 40. So if, in fact, these agreements both started with a prefatory clause that said, the following terms and conditions shall be considered unless otherwise provided by law. If the whole agreement had that preface on it, would it be okay?
I don't think so because it puts the court to a difficult task. It puts the court to a task of saying, okay, there are all these rules, but if they're so bad that we can't enforce them, what are we going to enforce? If essentially you interpret a contract that says, well, it has to incorporate all of Chapter 40 rights and remedies in order to be enforceable, in order to not be unconscionable, then it puts the court to the task of rewriting the agreement.
Unless otherwise provided by law, means Chapter 40 is at least impliedly contained within that agreement.
As much as I would appreciate or hope that every trial court has the same interpretation as Your Honor in terms of what would apply in the absence of the improper provisions, I don't think that that really is something we can count on. And I think that's part of the reason that we have all these arbitration appeals is to provide some guidance both to the trial courts and to practitioners about how we can interpret agreements that are clearly designed to restrict homeowner rights and enhance the developer's rights in such a way that they are both enforceable and yet not enforceable as to unconscionable terms. So if we provide them the out that says, as long as they put five or six words at the beginning of the agreement that says, okay, this is a good, unless it's not enforceable by law, we have removed the downside from drafting those overreaching agreements. And I think that would be a problem. It would be a problem.
Where do you get the procedural unconscionability from? Let's just focus on that. Justice Cherry asked you, you need both. So tell me why each of the two forms of agreement are procedurally unconscionable.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the U.S. home agreement, it has to do with the basically hidden size of the agreement, of the arbitration terms.
But what do you do with Concepcion, then, which says, in accord with the text of the statute, that you treat an arbitration agreement or an arbitration clause like any other clause of a contract? So this is not in tiny print. It is not, printed in Chinese. It's as legible as everything else in this contract.
In terms of the Concepcion case, I think the court did express those comments about the agreement itself. But I think the overwhelming factor in the Concepcion case was the lack of any substantive unconscionability. Because the court may recall that was an agreement that dealt with your $40 monthly phone bill, and the provision says that AT&T was to pay all costs of the mediation and arbitration in that case. It said further that if there's any award in favor of the subscriber, it was a minimum award of $2,500 for a $40 phone bill problem, plus the payment of legal fees to the subscriber. So that is, I've used that description in earlier trial court arguments to say, if that's an agreement that Lennar or U.S. Home or Greystone were to write and say similar terms, I'd say sign us up in a second.
But you're switching gears here. I'm on procedural, not substantive.
I understand, Your Honor. But I believe in terms of the sliding scale that the hidden nature and nothing to draw attention to the particular construction defect aspects of this claim, it follows the paragraphs about defaults by the buyer, defaults by the seller, credit reports, times of the essence. This is the context in which those paragraphs are described, and they basically refer to all kinds of disputes. Now, there is the language property damage within that paragraph, but that is hidden to interpret the inclusion of the term property damage, nothing about defects, nothing about Chapter 40, but to interpret that single phrase property damage as to be something that would alert a home buyer that construction defect disputes are part of that is still a bit of a stretch.
But that would be a substantive problem with it rather than a procedural one, correct?
I think procedural deals with notice as well. It's okay. Not just how tiny the print is. It's some notice about the provisions and their importance.
Okay, so tell me why the Honecker form of agreement is procedurally unconscionable. Procedurally.
I acknowledge it is not as bad as some of the things that have come before this court in terms of agreements. It does set out as a separate agreement, but procedurally, it seems to, again, refer to any number of issues that could be part of this mediation or arbitration process. It does little or nothing to highlight the Chapter 40 aspect or the property damage aspect or the... There is a reference... it refers to the warranty claims. There is some sort of overlap with the questions of construction that might be met, but I think it is still does not emphasize either the Chapter 40 rights, the importance of those rights, or the highlights that defects are to be considered by this situation. Frankly, the other aspect of it is of these 13 original homeowners, and remember these are the only original homeowners were part of the motion at the trial court, none of the subsequent buyers. There is nothing in the record that says even if there's even one more homeowner than the Honeckers who are subject to this separate Greystone agreement. They did not produce the agreements for any homeowners except two families. So for, I don't know whether that, if this court were to conclude that there is enough procedural conscionability in a separate agreement, to whom does that apply? Anyone other than...
Well, it would apply to Mr. and Mrs. Honecker.
It may. I understand that.
So do you concede that this is not procedurally unconscionable?
I'm not conceding it. I don't think it is as procedurally unconscionable as either other cases the court has addressed or as the U.S. home.
What I really hear you arguing, though, is that as a matter of substantive law, the arbitration agreement itself is inconsistent with Chapter 40, and therefore, as a matter of public policy, we should not enforce it. That seems to me really all your answers go to that.
I think that is the central point made in the Gonski case anyway, and I think that's been a central point in the trial court analyses that have consistently ruled against the enforcement of these arbitration provisions. I think it is that sort of overwhelming attempt to create a private repeal to a public statute that created a public, that expressed the public policy in favor of restoring homes to their proper construction, I think that's been a major factor at the trial court level, and I would suggest this should be a major factor here as well.
Does it give you any comfort that Mr. King perhaps conceded that all the rights and remedies under Chapter 40 would be afforded under that arbitration provision in any event?
I don't think it's helpful. I don't think a concession, either in the brief or in the argument, provides sufficient precedent for, again, guidance for the practitioners of the trial courts. I think that clearly since they're, not clearly, but since their actual contract did not state that, the concession that it should be interpreted to include the existence of Chapter 40 rights, it goes beyond what should be done.
But factually, isn't it true that in this case there was an earlier complaint filed that was then dismissed without prejudice in order to complete the pre-filing obligations that are set forth in Chapter 40?
Yes.
Which certainly indicates an awareness and a desire to comply with the mandates of that chapter.
Only as to the inspections and their right to repair and their responses.
But it's a general rule of contract law that if how the parties act is a testament to how they interpreted their contract obligations, correct?
I understand that, Your Honor, correct. But I think that the we have received, it's not really in the record, but it is common practice these days for a developer side to insist on their right to inspect and right to repair and so forth, and then file a motion to compel arbitration, regardless of any, without any kind of concession that Chapter 40 applies to damages, to recovered fees and costs, to interest, or that sort of thing.
But why isn't it an answer that the arbitrator, like the court, must interpret the contract according to applicable law, and if indeed the arbitrator manifestly disregards it, there is a later judicial review of that, and indeed the award can be vacated and remanded back if they do that?
As I understand the appeal from arbitration, there are very limited grounds, and there is a certain amount of discretion to the arbitrator.
The disregard of the law would be a pretty straight pass.
Yeah. I don't believe that provides sufficient assurance to the if the court were to interpret it and say, we'll interpret the arbitration provisions if it's all done in compliance with Chapter 40, that is, all the damages, what qualifies as a defect, all the recoverable items, interest, their obligation to repair within a certain time period, their obligation to respond to inspections, their obligation to provide a report about the repairs they did. I think that's certainly an option to the court to say that public policy is so strong in Chapter 40 that we will essentially add it on to any arbitration provision. But I think
the question would be for the arbitrator to decide in the first instance, and then we would review it.
Some of these provisions have terms that say arbitrators are determined what's arbitrable, but not all of them do.
Well, this one doesn't have that.
I was just thinking about it because we're dealing with...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
This may not have been the court's question, but the question of whether or not the arbitrator would be deciding whether or not Chapter 40 applies.
Right.
I think that's, in particular in the face of agreements that seem to intentionally limit the claims to what they choose to be sued for. There are limitations as to liability, limitations as to defects, limitations as to implied warranties. I think that basically is too unpredictable. I think the public policy of Chapter 40, if it's going to remain as strong as it was in Gotsky, needs to be addressed. The only thing I would...
Well, what do you do, though, with the... These are governed by the FAA, and the federal interpretation of the FAA, and it's obligatory for us to follow the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, there are, I think Justice Douglas expressed it, numerous beat-down cases where state courts are corrected for not following the FAA. I'm troubled by your idea that we're supposed to say we don't trust a correct outcome in arbitration because this right is so important. What about the nursing homes in West Virginia in, I forget the name of the case, but...
Your Honor, I would answer this way. There is nothing inherently inconsistent between Chapter 40 and the FAA. There is nothing in Chapter 40 that says you cannot decide this by arbitration. So it is not a state statute that conflicts with the Federal Arbitration Act. Frankly, personally, I disagree that the FAA applies, but I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters because there is sufficient Nevada case law that says that Nevada does favor arbitration, that's almost word for word with the FAA terms, to favor arbitration. But that does not mean that Nevada or the FAA favors arbitration on unconscionable terms. It does not. In fact, it expressly says that contracts that are not enforceable either in law or in equity provide a defense to a proposed arbitration terms. And that's really what this is. I mean, we can talk about it. This is really an attempt to evade or repeal Chapter 40 but disguised as an arbitration.
I took issue with that. The question I asked last a few minutes ago had to do with the fact that this case was dismissed without prejudice in order to follow at least the pre-Chapter 40 procedure. So I think that is disingenuous at best. Number two, if we look directly to the policy of Chapter 40, the policy there was not necessarily to get us into litigation and to make sure that everyone has their damages and their attorney's fees paid, but frankly, the underlying policy was to be sure that homeowners in the valley or throughout our state are living in homes that are safe. So it was the right to repair first that came first. So my question is, if you have the ability to enjoy, you and your clients have the ability to enjoy that possible remedy, and it appears in this case by the actions of the home builders that they were at least going to go along with Chapter 40 in terms of the pre-litigation stages, why do we need to be concerned that they wouldn't follow through in the rest of the processes if the right to repair wasn't adequate?
They didn't offer to repair anything. Not one thing. Not one thing. I don't know if that was frankly part of the record on this because it didn't come up, but that was the dismissal of the first case. But there was not an offer to dismiss one thing, or I mean to repair one thing. So I think the elements of the Chapter 40 that were followed in the sort of the predecessor case, if you will, was the right to inspect and to be involved and so forth, but that was the end of that process. And I think at this point, the absence of any language either in the agreement, in the contracts, or in the actions that the intend to allow the rest of Chapter 40 to be applied as to damages, fees and costs, interest, and so forth, there's nothing that would support that conclusion. Thank you.
Colleagues, any other questions?
I have one.
You do?
I do. Why isn't what you're arguing akin to the cases where somebody tries to say you can't have class arbitration? In other words, it damages what you want to do to fulfill your client's rights, but nonetheless, that procedure is upholdable mandatorily under federal case law.
In two respects, it's different. One, there's the California statute that seemed to prohibit that, and there was an actual California statute that contradicted the Federal Arbitration Act. Clearly, FAA preempts that. With respect to the AT&T Conception case that had the anti-class action provisions, it was basically, again, that goes back to the very conscionable terms of the AT&T provision.
Okay.
The trade-off was, yes, you can have class action nationwide, but you get a very good remedy and a very good right one by one. You get to recover what amounts to...
I don't read that case as emphasizing that as much. I agree with you, it's in the facts, but it is, I'm not sure that that's the basis for saying that the class waiver must be enforced.
And again, there is no, whether it's class waiver or joinder waiver or whatever it may be, that I think probably does not rise to an unconscionable level because you're still allowed to pursue a remedy. But when you simply take out the whole, the very liability in terms of defect definitions.
And you're affecting the substantive rights, is your point.
Those are the substantive rights that are eliminated.
Understand. Thank you. Thank you, Justice.
Yes, of course. All right, Mr. King, you got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. I think counsel's argument highlights some of the tension here. If I heard what he said, he seemed to change his position midstream, and that's what's happened a lot. There's real confusion at the lower court level in light of D.R. Horton, in light of Gonski, which were pre-Concepcion, and then in light of Concepcion and the beatdown cases that Justice Douglas talked about. There's real confusion at the district court level. And
but counsel, as you talk about real confusion, that's part of our dilemma today. We have the words on the page that say one thing, you're telling us the interpretation is something else. Doesn't that lead us to the possibility that someone else could interpret them and make them into something, in a third something else?
I think I'm sure this court's aware we have many appeals up by different justices.
Oh, yes, we're
by three different dirt court judges. and there seems to be a real reluctance, and there seems to be this idea, which was articulated by counsel, that arbitration and Chapter 40 cannot go hand in hand, and that flies in the face of Concepcion. I think counsel's interpretation of...
Well, not necessarily flies in the face. The real issue is it adequately set out that would allow a reasonable person to be able to make an informed decision?
Sure. I think that the standard, the burden articulated by counsel as well, as far as what needs to be in an arbitration agreement, it's not realistic. He wants a full articulation of all your rights under Chapter 40 and a definition of property damage. And the statute is the statute.
You conceded that if we struck something, it would be a better statement.
Absolutely.
So you're, in essence, going toward his argument that what is stated is not fairly articulated.
I agree there is the line in the Greystone Agreement that seems to contradict Chapter 40 rights, absolutely. If I could just make one comment on waiver.
Sure.
That hasn't come up. That was a ruling by the lower court. The primary focus on waiver is prejudice. The lower court found no, it didn't make a finding of prejudice, and this court should not make a factual determination that the lower court did not determine. That should be overruled without question.
All right. Colleagues, any other questions?
So you're suggesting that you didn't waive your right to go to arbitration with a properly drafted arbitration agreement?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your presentations and your briefing on this matter. This matter is submitted. We'll stand in recess until 11 o'clock.